Welcome to this episode of George Buys a Vowel, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle, joined by, as always, one of my favorite Lopez lovers. Tim, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I've had a couple days off of work due to a COVID scare, so I've been putting some time into the Miles Morales game.
I thought you were gonna start reading after Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, I was gonna, but
I mean, it's like reading, I guess. It's a comic-related thing.
Well, the game is apparently only 8 to 10 hours, so I figure I can knock it out this week.
You might be short. It's a good excuse. So, I was very excited, Tim. I know in the past we had tried to cover this episode, so I was very excited to do it. But I actually got some bad news, Tim.
We're starting the new year off with bad news.
Yeah, I know 2021 we wanted to really get to covering an episode of George Lopez, especially the one where George fakes a wedding for his boss to cover renewing his vows to Angie, but Angie is planning a fake wedding. She begins to ask too many details, so Jack buys a woman named Del, played by guest star Jennifer Hasty. That seems problematic.
Did you say buys a woman?
Yeah, that's what they wrote in the Wikipedia. As a fake wife, so on the day of the real wedding, George can surprise her. We actually have a really good interview, and I'm pretty sure he interrupted last time we tried to do this, but very excited. We have a writer and creator, and this time I don't have to ask his name because I listened to it last time. David Pepos, how you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Happy to catch up with you guys.
Yeah, I listened to last time, and I was like, I did all the research to ask the name, and then I had you, and it's like this time I was like, I'm prepared.
You know, I've having lived with this name for over 3 decades now. Pepos is kind of like a choose your own adventure name. I've heard every possible permutation. I've had people throw in some extra consonants, a few extra vowels. You know, it's like a bad, Wheel of Fortune, game. But, so you got it right on the first try. So, thank you. You win a prize, which is my undying love. And, I'm excited to chat about what's new.
So we're recording this on the Wednesday. So excited about getting the name right. I forgot to mention, we're going to be talking about the first issue of Scout's Honor. That if you like, when we're recording this, it dropped today. I had originally had like talk about like what the book and stuff like this, but then I've just seen David all day on Twitter, like nonstop. Like you were like anyone that is like picks up the book, tags the book. Like David is like, we were joking before over our emails, like kind of teaming up with Aftershock for this one, like they're kind of like stepping in for a lot of the promotion on this, but like you're still like in fucking go mode, like any like thanking everyone and anyone that like drops the books. Like, how has today been for you?
It's been great. I honestly couldn't be more thrilled with the reception to Scout's Honor, especially in a week that is so creatively stacked. DC rolling out a half dozen Future State books, Marvel doing Eternals and some new Star Wars books, down to just kind of usual suspects like, you know, Donny Cates has another issue of Crossover out. And I feel really grateful and fortunate that people have been responding to the book. I feel like, you know, working with Aftershock, it is sort of the next step up in my career. It's certainly the biggest platform that I've been fortunate enough to have, and I think it comes down to, I've always had kind of an army of readers and retailers and journalists who have been gracious and generous enough to really kind of step up to the plate every time I've put work out. And so when I get to a bigger platform like this, that army, that village, however you want to call it, they've really stepped up in a commensurate fashion, and so I'm really grateful for everyone, because this book would not have any traction if it wasn't for them.
Yeah, I saw on the news today there were some sort of riots happening in DC, and I had assumed they were too. go out and pick up Scout's Honor. I was in follow-up with the news. I wasn't really sure what was going on, but
it was a mass rush to get the book.
When I had written a book about, you know, a military fetishizing hyper-masculine cult, I didn't think it was going to be a documentary. I can say, for those who don't know what Scout's Honor is about, the series is years after a nuclear war, a cult has risen from the ashes, and their Bible is an old Boy Scout manual. So our series follows Kit, who's a young initiate for the Ranger Scouts of America, and really embodies everything that they've come to represent in terms of their central doctrine and tenets. There's just one catch. Kit's society is this sort of hyper-masculine cult that only allows men to serve. And so she's had to conceal her identity as a woman in order to pursue her true calling as a Ranger Scout. Unfortunately, Kit's going to make a pretty chilling discovery that cuts all the way back to the creation of the Ranger Scouts. And it's going to kind of turn her whole worldview off its axis. So she's going to find herself losing her religion a bit as she undertakes a dangerous quest for the truth. When you talk about a post-apocalyptic Boy Scout cult in, you know, January 6, 2021, you can't escape the parallels. We saw them climbing into the Capitol building today. But I think for me, as having written it, you know, comics, I think they take a lot longer than a lot of people expect. I had initially pitched this idea, I believe it was July or August of 2019. So pre-pandemic, pre-election, pre-riots. And the way that it tends to go with the comics industry, even sort of at the fastest of times, it took until about Christmas to get the project greenlit. That was after I'd written a script and an outline, a first issue script. And then we got the paperwork signed about 2 weeks before lockdown. And so writing this book, about 80% of it during lockdown, was definitely a jarring experience for me. I spent a lot of time kind of thinking, what kind of energy do I want to put out into the world? You know, not to sound like too Grant Morrison-y or, you know, magical thinking, but between that and my Kickstarter for my last book, The OZ, which is kind of a dystopian war fantasy, you know, it's kind of hard to be like, you know, am I jinxing myself? Am I jinxing the world? But I'm kind of glad that I wrote through those fears and anxieties a bit. Because anybody who's read my work, I think the thing that most of my work has in common is that I start in kind of these kind of dark, bleak places, and then I work my way out. Like, it's never just about the bleak high concept, but it's about, like, the kind of redemptive journey out of it. And writing Scout's Honor, I feel like it's ultimately about building a better world. It's ultimately about turning a corner. I know that things today don't look like we're turning a corner, but I have faith that corner's coming. And I think as long as there are people who are willing to fight for it and willing to persevere for it and willing to endure for it, I think better days are coming. And I truly believe that, having written this. And I think by the time that the series concludes, hopefully we'll all have turned a corner in a way.
That's what I was going to... So last time we did an episode together, like I said, it was right before, we're talking, going to the chapel when the trade dropped, and writing, I mean, obviously kind of being in the headspace of this post-apocalyptic world and writing it within COVID being its own thing. But as a writer, I mean, I think people have the idea of writers, you know, sitting in coffee shops or sitting at home, like, did your writing process or the way you approached your day-to-day change at all? Kind of living in that world where you couldn't really explore more?
Sure. Well, a lot of things changed, and a lot of things changed going into the pandemic. When last we spoke, and I know we all talked about it, probably behind the scenes, but my last dog, Holly, she was ending her battle with cancer. She passed the same weekend that I signed, or no, she passed shortly before I signed the contract for Scouts Honor. We buried her about an hour after I signed the contract. So that in and of itself was a big amount of bandwidth that suddenly was gone. I was no longer taking a dog to radiation appointments. But I think even moreover, beyond sort of my stuff as a cancer dog dad, is something about the comics industry that I don't love is, you know, our storytelling is serialized, and there's so many people, there are all these basically independent contractors that are all sort of beating on the same doors. We're all trying to get projects out, and of course setbacks are a thing, and you know, it's hard to kind of escape that rat race a little bit, and sort of that feeling in your head of, oh man, I got to get more stuff out. Oh, somebody else has gotten stuff out. You know, why didn't I get my stuff out? Even if the, you know, your friend's projects are nothing like anything you would write and something you probably wouldn't even have a good time writing. You know, during the pandemic, honestly, everything felt a little streamlined. You know, I was already working from home. I wasn't traveling for conventions anymore. When Diamond had its temporary shutdown, there were no releases, and everybody was kind of figuring out, like, how are we going to pivot? What are we going to do next? It honestly made me more productive, which I feel weird and guilty saying that, but I finished 4 series during quarantine, and I wrote and produced a bunch of shorts, and a bunch more outlines that I'm in the process of scripting now. I think kind of getting out of my own head with sort of, you know, what am I doing right now? What's everybody else doing right now? It kind of ultimately resulted in some better work, some more focused work. And so that's something I'm definitely sort of thinking about in 2021 and beyond, seeing how I can kind of temper that a little bit. But yeah, you know, the Scouts Honor in particular was an interesting and fun learning curve because it was very different than any other series that I've worked on. You know, by virtue of, this is really the first time I've ever worked with editors. I know that sounds kind of glib to say, but there's a big difference between doing, say, your own Kickstarter, where obviously the buck stops with you, or, you know, working at a place like Action Lab, where they have editors, but like they don't really have the bandwidth to be like reading scripts or anything like that. Their editors are more of just to make sure that the thing can be printed in terms of a production sense, or, you know, very mild copy editing. Aftershock, I was working with editors. And so this is the first time, for example, that I've ever had my creative team match made for me, which that takes a whole lot of bandwidth out of the equation for me. Not being the central editorial conduit is something that also kind of changes the way that I do things. I'm so used to, with all of my books, if there's something that I want to have tweaked, because the buck stops with me as sort of the central editorial figure, I'm the ones that, you know, telling my artist, hey, can we tweak this thing in layouts? Or saying to a colorist, hey, can we like tweak the saturation here? Or telling, you know, asking a poor letter, hey, I threw a typo in this, can we fix it? For this, I was working with Christina Harrington and Mike Martz. And so it became a little bit of a game of telephone where you would, you know, I would say, hey, we got these layouts, here's my thoughts on it. Mike and Christina would kind of look at those notes, have a sense of whether or not it was a battle they felt was worth fighting, would then pass that to my artist, Luca Castellanguida. It was actually Luca's agent who would then translate those notes to Luca, who is not a native English speaker. So that really kind of changed the way that I write scripts. I'm a little less streamlined and Spartan with how I do it, just because I want to make sure that I measure twice and cut once. I think beyond that, I think there was a little bit of pressure, a little bit of added pressure. Not even so much about Aftershock being a bigger place, although I'm very fortunate and grateful that they are, and I've been kind of banging on their doors since my first book came out, so it's been a long time coming. But in particular, I didn't want to disappoint Mike. I've known Mike Martz since I was in college. He was the editor of the Batman line the summer that I interned at DC Comics, so the summer of 2008. And for those who don't know, that summer, that was the summer of Batman RIP, Final Crisis, and the first global economic recession.
Pretty quiet there, year.
There were no jobs when I interned at DC, and for me, it was a big kind of wake-up call. I had gone from thinking I had a very, you know, a robust resume and that I could sort of call my own shots to getting a reality check pretty quickly that, you know, no, I was going to have to really scramble to find any work, let alone, you know, my dream job, which I thought was going to be a DC Comics editor. And Mike was the one who was kind enough to sit me down in an office that was pretty busy. You know, they don't really have time to sit interns down. But Mike was kind enough to sit me down, and he goes, you know, not people don't just walk into the Yankees. And by that, he meant, you know, people start, you know, if you want to be in professional baseball, you know, you start in the minor leagues, and you work on farm teams, and you work on some of the smaller teams and the mid-tier teams. And then eventually you wind up on the Yankees or the Red Sox or whatever big team that, you know, you want to put yourself on. And it made me realize this was not the end of my path to the comics industry. This was the first step. And that really, I think that conversation really kind of gave me the endurance to kind of chisel my way, kind of Shawshank my way into comics over, really over a decade. And it, more importantly, I think it really taught me to kind of expand my horizons a bit. There are some aspiring creators who they say, I want to write Spider-Man. Right. I want to write Batman. That's their life goal. And, you know, when you start to think about it, there are more professional NBA players than there are people who have written Spider-Man.
Yep.
You know, and not only that, it's a very limiting goal. Even if you get that goal, that's a goal with a very finite shelf life. What are you going to do after you've written Spider-Man if that's your life's goal? So it made me kind of realize, like, there's so much more to comics. There are so many different types of stories and genres and publishers that you can work with. And even though I didn't know I wanted to be a writer at that point, I think that conversation was kind of like the snowball that started rolling down the mountain. And so I have always felt that I've owed Mike Martz my career. And so the idea of him actually being my editor instead of my intern boss, I felt like I had something to prove. I didn't want to let him down. And having worked with Christina Harrington on this book, I kind of feel the same way with her now too. I think she's probably the single best editor I've ever worked with. You know, even dating back to my intern days, she has championed this book since the initial pitch. I've been told that she was sort of the final litmus test for Aftershock to decide whether or not they wanted to take it. And she really helped matchmake the team, particularly with artist Luca Kessel-Linguida, and especially our colorist Matt Milla. When Christina said, hey, what do you think about having Matt Milla in the book? I distinctly remember my reaction being, are we allowed to do that? you know, because like, he's so talented. You've seen his work on Daredevil. He really has been bringing in the goods, for this series. And I think that is because of Christina and Mike really kind of making sure that this book, punches outside of its weight class. And I think for our first book at a place like Aftershock, that's exactly the kind of mentality that I wanted going in.
Well, I mean, I think to have that kind of mindset, no spoilers, like it's fantastic first issue, and
thank you.
I think that's something, I mean, we talked about with going to the chapel, and I mean even referencing stuff on Spencer and Locke, and
sure.
Something we've discussed a lot with creators is like, I think like kind of the advice like I think people give to new writers and stuff like that isn't like you said, don't tackle your space opera for your first book, yeah. because you're punching outside the box. Like, you need to learn to write a creative story, and that's why I think, like, people who, a lot of times now we're seeing people who either come in through Kickstarter or anthologies or short stories, and like, that's kind of where you hone that skill. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, from you seeing kind of like you were able to early on build smart, tight stories, and like Spencer and Locke, like, is key. And then, like, the kind of way you tackled a story in going to the chapel and really told the story with these characters, and like evolved it. And then once you have that, you can kind of then if you want, like, to write a Spider-Man comic, you can, because you can, like, a Spider-Man comic is like, that's just, you know, that's just a skin on something else. Like, you can tell any story after that.
Well, you know, and the other thing is, and I think Scout's Honor has kind of really helped highlight that for me in sharp relief, because I feel like this book has, it's kind of stepping in those two worlds. It's got just as much in common with Work for Hire as it does Creator Owned, because, and this is me kind of going into the weeds a little bit of the production process, but, there are some places like Image or Action Lab, for example. They want you to have your whole team together. They want you to have your full outline and script. You put the package together and then you throw it out there and it's thumbs up or thumbs down. It's very binary. Then there are places like Aftershock or Boom, where they want to be a little more hands-on and really kind of help you with the development. They want to sort of bring in their vision and wed it in with your vision and sort of figure out the overlap and where you can elevate each other. And so it kind of goes back to, this is the first time I worked with editors. And so it's not just me telling the story just to tell the story, but I'm also kind of figuring out, all right, like, I've got a vision that I have in mind. My editors are sort of representing the vision that my publishers have in mind. And where can we kind of feed into each other on that? That's a skill set that you need for, you know, if you want to go on to licensed books like the big two, or like the stuff that IDW, you know, is doing with the Hasbro line, because ultimately you will have hoops that you need to jump through. And I think it's very, and I've been guilty of this, I think it's easy when you haven't done it to be like, oh, well, why don't you just kind of cut out the middleman and just do, you know, the very easy, direct thing. And then you realize, oh, like, some of that's institutional. Some of that is you kind of have to be a little bit more nimble with the way you do it. And so it's funny. I'm sure anybody can think of a writer who's had, like, a meteoric rise to fame, and then they show up at, like, a huge platform, and they aren't performing at the level that you're used to, you know? And I have the feeling that they know that too. Some of that, I think, is they tried running before they could walk, you know? And so I actually consider myself kind of fortunate that I've had the time to keep honing my skills. Because I feel like if I had, for example, gone straight to, I don't know, Marvel, right after my first book, I would have flamed out hard. I know that now. And so experiences like Scout's Honor, I think, are really, it's good future proofing. You know, I say this in every interview, but I want to be a 30-year man. You know, I want to be in this industry for the long haul. And so I always look at my content in that sort of existential lens of how do we bring more people to the table. But Scout's Honor really kind of also reminded me there's a flip side to that. It's how do you sustainably pace yourself in terms of making these comics? How do you maintain your level of quality, your expectations, your values, so to speak, while still being able to perform at a rate that is of professional expectations? I think this has been a really, really positive experience in that regard. I always say, you know, look, if the big two came calling, of course, you know, opportunity knocks, I want to answer. But until then, I see people like, I'm going to throw a name out there, Donny Cates, for example, you know, he blew up with God Country and then Venom in kind of rapid succession. But that was, he was toiling in the indie trenches for a very long time.
Oh yeah.
And I feel like that time in the wilderness is the reason why he came out swinging on those big books, and why he has been able to avoid some of the pitfalls that other people who have sort of done, maybe done one or two books before, you know, hitting it big. Because
look at, like, you know, someone like Hickman, who's like essentially running the show at Marvel right now. Like, he was writing and drawing his own books, like, at Image for a long time prior to it. Same with Neil Bendis. Like, all those noir books were like his, like, really basic drawings.
You can sense when creators have had more time to kind of like find and develop their own voice, and versus when creators are so hungry for the big time. And my thought is, I would much rather it take me longer to get there and do it right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm having the time of my life telling creator-owned stories. And, you know, I'm fortunate and grateful that a place like Aftershock would, you know, take a shot on me. But even if they didn't, I'd be doing Kickstarters. You know, there, nobody's going to stop me from telling comics, writing comics. I'm going to have to get hit by a bus first. But that said, you know, I want to make sure that when opportunity knocks, I'd like to put in enough reps that I can answer the door and actually be ready for it.
That seems interesting for, especially for Scouts on, like, I mean, you mentioned this kind of being... the most different of your work so far.
Sure.
And it obviously feels that way kind of in the, I think in the scope of what you're covering, and then also kind of the theme. Sure. But it's so interesting to kind of have that approach going in, because, like, again, this is a book where you're doing a lot of world building. There's a lot of design and the stuff like that. And then to have that be your first kind of attempt to do that. I mean, obviously there's some of that with Spencer and Love, but like the amount of world building that goes into that, and then kind of having then to filter that through a team, and like you said, kind of the translation with Luca being Italian and kind of all of that, and then having it to be come out so cohesive is again kind of a testament to everyone on the team being able to kind of navigate those things and be in service of the story, which again, like, I think for your first kind of foray into that team aspect and kind of this book, like, it looks beautiful. It is a really cohesive and tight first issue. So
thank you. You know, it's funny because, I mean, in one regard, I feel fortunate, because I had been working on my previous book, The OZ, which I did on Kickstarter, over the summer, that I'd been working on for a while. So I think I had been kind of building up to this degree of world building. I do consider The OZ and Scout's Honor a little bit of, like, shot and chaser. You know, if you like one, you'll probably like the other. You know, one being sort of a dystopian fantasy war, and the other being this, like, post-apocalyptic cult. But yeah, you know, it's funny. I came up with this idea for Scout's Honor. And first off, you know, what's so funny about it is, like I said, you know, Aftershock is a publisher, you know, they want to help kind of develop and help shape the book just as much as I do. And so the way that it had worked was I had sent them actually a number of ideas over the years, and some of them didn't work out just in terms of length, things like Grand Theft Astro, things like the OZ, those were both too long. Other ideas just, you know, didn't quite fit what they were looking for. So at one point, I asked Lee Kramer, the president of the company. I had lunch with him here in Los Angeles, and I was kind of like, Lee, I want to, you know me, you can't get rid of me. I keep seeing you at cons. I live in your backyard. Like, let's get something on the books. What do you want me to pitch you? Like, how do you want me to pitch you this stuff? And he was like, you know, just send me some log lines and we'll work from there. And I was kind of like, any idea how many? He goes, send me what you want. Big mistake, Lee. So I sent them like a dozen ideas, and some of which I'm still working on now. Others are sort of on the back burner. I'm kind of retooling now. But what's funny is Scout's Honor had actually been the most recent idea I had put on the list. I had I've been watching a show called The Path with Aaron Paul. It's on Hulu. Really underrated show. It's basically about a Scientology-style cult and what happens when a father who's in this cult kind of gets disillusioned with it and starts breaking free. And how does that affect him, and how does that affect his family, and how does that affect kind of the de facto second-in-command of this cult? And I had been thinking, you know, what's like the weirdest thing that somebody could use as a Bible? You know, just what's the weirdest basis for a religion? And I'm glad I didn't do something like a D&D manual, because that would have been like a much shorter book. But I when I thought about the Boy Scout manual, you know, things started clicking pretty quick. My younger brothers both served as Boy Scouts. I did not. And so I think that outsider looking in really kind of was the initial kernel of it all. You know, for them, it's, you know, you're learning practical skills, and there's the camaraderie, and hanging out with your friends. And on the outside, though, you know, you got the costumes and the laws and the merit badges, and you don't have to squint too hard for it to look a little like a cult. And as I thought about it, I was kind of like, oh, like, you know, this kind of represents our country a bit. You know, the toxic masculinity, the fetishization of the military and survivalism, the rise of evangelical thinking and sort of this dissuasion of critical thought in higher education. You know, you put that in a cauldron and, you know, nuke it and then let it sit for 200 years, you might get the Ranger Scouts of America. I think I tend to gravitate towards ideas that have a lot of built-in imagery, whether it's something like Spencer and Locke, where we're riffing on Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes, or going to the chapel, where you're just bouncing off of wedding imagery. And the Boy Scouts have such a cool set of iconography, mm-hmm. you know, that we were able to kind of really find the religion in. Things like the merit badges, which are kind of like their communion in a way, and their coming of age. But it's also like there's a military element to it, because you want, you know, your troop, you want to be able to know what your brothers' skill sets are just by looking at them. Or things like the seven scout laws, which had been mutated from the actual Boy Scout laws in the Boy Scout manual. Because things like "you shall obey your scoutmaster without question," that's exactly what a cult would tell you, you know? There's something a little autobiographical about the book, though. I don't talk about it a whole lot in my other work, because it doesn't usually register, but I grew up in a pretty conservative house in Missouri, both politically and religiously. I'm still a practicing Jew. But
you're still practicing? You haven't got there yet?
I'm still a practicing Jew, but the thing is that my political and religious reawakening really took place after I left home. I very quickly realized that a lot of things that I thought were bedrock pillars of reality were really not so. And it can be really disorienting, you know, finding out that all these things that you took as fact and sort of informed your worldview, that no, it's not accurate. It's not real, you know? And at the same time, you know, in the religious sense of things, you know, for those listening who, you know, aren't Jewish or don't know Jewish people, you know, it's a religion that's built for literary criticism. You know, you have five different rabbis having five different interpretations of the same text, and you know, they're leaving the apocryphal stuff in you know, the margins of the Siddur. So yeah, it's just for me, it's sort of my way of throwing a penny in the well of the universe, so to speak. And kind of connecting with those who came before and the people who can't practice and the people who have died trying to practice. But my spiritual journey and the way that I practice my Judaism and I identify as a Jew is very different than my parents' journey, which is very different than their parents' journey. And I think that really bled into Kit's journey a bit. in this series, you know. Another big inspiration was the Catholic priest scandals. My partner was raised Catholic, and she's no longer a member of the church, and the Catholic priest scandals are what really kind of drove her away, because she was thinking, you know, how do I associate with an institution that's kept stuff like this under the rug? And that kind of dissonance is something that a lot of people have when, you know, sort of, you know, facing their religion and figuring out where they want to go. And that's Kit's arc to a T. It's sort of, how do you maintain those ethical and spiritual values that define you? Because, you know, she is a true believer. She believes that the Ranger Scouts can build a better tomorrow and a better world. But she's also kind of losing her religion because she has to navigate this human institution that isn't just flawed, isn't just failing, but can be downright sinister. And I think when you take away sort of the Boy Scout trappings and the post-apocalyptic setting, this is a story of a small town conservative kid finding out that the way they were raised might not be the way the world works, and kind of having to reorient and figure out their shit on the fly. And that might bring Kit head to head, not just with like the dangers of the Colorado Badlands, but just head to head with the people that she's known and loved and trusted the most.
Yeah, I think that's, for me, that was like kind of the most interesting thing about the first issue. And I felt that way kind of with going to the chapel, kind of the way you morph that. It was like, I feel like the low hanging fruit, or like kind of the easy storyline, would be her being a woman again, mm-hmm. trying to infiltrate this group and be part of, like, I feel like obviously that is a part of the story, sure. and a part of her character, but like the way you kind of end on the reveal of the revelation of the Scouts versus the revelation of her being a female, like, cements that this book is again about her journey within the Scouts and them versus like her being a female trying to like be a part of this man's world, which obviously, like, again, is interesting, and it feels like it is going to be part of the story, but like the more interesting aspect is her journey within this and her conflict and coming to terms with less about who she is as a female, but more about who she is within this
culture
group that she's kind of identified with and hidden her identity to be a part of.
Yes. You really just hit it on the head. I mean, beyond sort of the theme of losing your religion and figuring out where to go from there, I'd say if there's two other themes that really kind of sum up Scout's Honor, the first one is toxic masculinity. And, you know, how that shapes the world and how people have to kind of navigate that through the world. But I think more importantly, it's also about how corrosive secrets can be and how stifling and isolating they can be. And then, you know, when you kind of rip those secrets off, how blinding the truth can be. You know, when I first came up with this concept, it took a bit to add in the element of Kit being a woman. And the way that turned out was, when I had first come up with this idea, first I thought maybe something like Lord of the Flies, you know, like, how do I isolate this group and sort of put them in a situation where they would view the Boy Scout manual as gospel? And I quickly realized that, you know, in the year 2020, when I was, or 2019, when I was coming up with it, you know, doing a story about all guys, like, is just not going to fly, you know? It's just not going to work. And I realized I could kind of solve one problem with the other by leaning into it, by having Kit be a woman, having to navigate this kind of twisted, messed up man's world, you know, in a way. But I think also some of this was, you know, if you've ever read Howard Zinn, you know, he talks about how, like, history is written by the victors. And history is kind of a game of telephone, you know? Like, it's humanity likes its continuity, and so you build on the story, and sometimes you mythologize that story, and sometimes the mythology kind of folds in itself. But I was thinking, you know, what happens if you cut that game of telephone? You know, people are going to scramble to find continuity any way they can with whatever scraps of the old world they can. But then, you know, you sort of start these Dark Ages with, you know, a new starting point with this Boy Scout manual. And then you see how history kind of mutates and twists as a result. The other thing that I thought was that I liked about Kit's story, you know, outside of sort of her spiritual struggles, having her as a woman in this, it really, it allowed me to kind of explore those themes of toxic masculinity, of sort of how do that kind of curdles things, and whether it's societies or people. And something, you know, and I guess this is a mild spoiler, but, you know, I think it's important to say, you know, her relationship with her best friend Dez is something that also kind of gets explored through that lens of toxic masculinity. Dez is the son of Scoutmaster Shepherd, who's kind of the political and spiritual leader of this cult. And Dez is sort of the Loki to Kit's Thor. They're childhood best friends, but Kit always manages to show him up. And so there's always a little degree of resentment going on that, you know, she keeps showing him up in front of his dad. But I thought, you know, if the world would be hard for a woman to navigate in this sort of toxic masculine world, Dez winds up sort of being, you know, how much harder do you think it would be for a member of the LGBTQ community? You know, it's sort of a tragic element with Kit and Dez's dynamics, is that even though they're each other's best friends, neither of them knows the other one's secret. And that's something that's going to kind of put them on a collision course as the series goes on. What's something that had been kind of a long simmering rivalry is going to turn hot real fast. And at the same time, I feel like Dez struggling with his sexuality, that kind of, that makes him a tragic figure to me. You know, I mean, like I said, I don't think the allegory of this being, you know, sort of a small conservative town, I don't think that's, we're being that subtle about it. And the idea of essentially a closeted preacher's son, you know, he's got a reason for wanting to lash out. He's got a reason for feeling this isolation. And I think that's really the thing that it, I think, sums up this story, is that secrets are isolating. You know, you constantly have these walls up, and you constantly have to be looking over your shoulder to make sure that you don't slip. And in the case of the Scouts, they have a secret that's like so long lost to history, but if it got out, it could really kind of upset the whole apple cart. And yet at the same time, that's the world we live in. We have to navigate secrets, and sometimes secrets explode in our face, and then we kind of have to try to walk it off, even though we're kind of been blinded by the truth. So I think that kind of struggle, beyond all the post-apocalyptic Boy Scout trappings, I think that's something that's, it's very relatable, because I think there are a lot of people who spend their entire lives struggling to live as their authentic selves, and it's often a lifelong journey.
And I think what's so interesting, and again, a lot of your career has been kind of taking either ideas or quandaries or kind of looks at societal issues and then kind of bending them through genres. And sure. I think the last episode we did was our like end of the year discussion, and like one of my favorite books of the year was Lolo Woods, because it was taking this idea of women's choice and agency, and something that I as a male cannot generally understand. I can kind of, you know, empathize and get the idea, but filtering it through a horror lens and tying it to something with agency that I can understand, you know, helps kind of cement that more. Yeah. And like with, like, that's what I enjoy most about kind of post-apocalyptic stories, is you're able to then kind of take that lens. We're like, you know, obviously being a female in a male's world is, again, difficult. And then also being like, you know, part of the LGBTQ community and having to hide that and be closeted is difficult. But it's, again, kind of a, I don't want to say abstract concept, but it is something for that is hard to fully understand. But putting the additional stakes on it of where these, you know, because you're setting it in this post-apocalyptic, you know, toxic setting, yeah, you're able to raise the stakes where they are literally life and death. And like, at least it's, I feel like if it's a way to use that genre to push that theme more to where like readers can, who may not otherwise empathize with it, are able to, because they are able to grasp the real consequences of it in that setting. And then hopefully, you know, transition that to how that would be a real consequence in the larger society that we live.
That's a great way. That's a great way of looking at it. And I think you've really kind of built one more layer to the thing that I'm constantly thinking about. And you and I have talked about this, if not on the show, then just at conventions that we've hung out at. But I look at comics existentially. You know, if we don't work overtime to be bringing in more people to the table and kind of, you know, wrangling in the readership diaspora that's gone to Kickstarter or Webtoons or, you know, or cons or what have you, we're not going to have a comics industry for much longer. And so I'm always kind of thinking about, like, what can we do to bring in more people to the table, and how can we, more importantly, show compassion to our readership? I try to be as compassionate with my characters as I can. It's part of the reason why I've been so upfront with things like Kit being a woman in this book, and comparing the book, you know, talking about Mulan as an influence, or talking about Dez, being a member of the gay community, is I don't want my books to be, I don't want those reveals to be seen as punchlines. I don't want them to be seen as titillating. Anything I can do to sort of prime a reader's expectations in that regard, so they feel welcomed and they don't feel like I'm punching down at them, is something that I want to do. I feel like as a straight white Jewish guy in Hollywood, I got it pretty good. And I know that there are a lot of people's lived in authentic experiences that I cannot authentically write about. It's just not my story to tell. I've had plenty of ideas that I have had to sort of put in the wastebasket because I just know that's not my story to tell. What I can do, though, is, you know, be as diverse with the characters I'm writing as possible. Because like you said, the more you just kind of make it normal, you know, that you sort of break free of the sort of homogenized pop culture landscape that we all were raised in and that we've all lived in up until, you know, we're only taking sort of the babiest of baby steps now. Mm-hmm. That's something I can do as a straight white Jewish guy in Hollywood. I'll be honest, it's low impact for me, but it's something that if I can, you know, invite another reader in and say, hey, I'm really not looking to sort of punch down at you. I'm looking to kind of invite you to the table and make you feel a part of this community that I've grown up loving so much. That's the sort of thing that pays dividends down the road. That's the sort of thing that shores up our industry. It makes it a more equitable place. It makes it a more inviting place. And the thing that I always say, you know, anytime that I see some man baby on the internet, you know, trying to gatekeep and saying, oh, these people aren't real fans, whatever, I'm just like, you're an idiot. Like, this doesn't just make, like, ethical sense. It makes creative and financial sense. Like, you want to have a thriving industry. And, you know, I do it both because I want to have an industry for me to work in, but I also do it because I want an industry that I want to love down the road, and I want to invite as many people to love that industry as I do. So I think your point about having that empathy and sort of having that expanded sort of hyper-realism to tell a more human point, I think is right on, you're dead on. I'm 100% agreement.
Yeah. Is that something, again, kind of having those understandings about the characters, but tackling the idea of kind of the larger idea of what the Scouts might be and kind of the doctrine they're coming from and how that might be perverted over time and stuff like that? Is that something that, like, research went into? Because much like your kind of experience as a kid, mine was much the same. I was never part of the Scouts, mm-hmm. but again, the pageantry and, like, mainly the costumes yeah. was of interest to me. And my sister joined the Brownies. That's a girl, right? Mm-hmm. Or
yep.
like the,
yep.
And so I occasionally went to, like, meetings with her because my mom would drag me along because sure. I couldn't be home. And yep. I was like, well, if I could join the Brownies because they get the costumes and they just, like, make crafts. Because, like, my biggest yep. thing with the Scouts was, like, I don't want to fucking go outside. Like, I just want to play yeah. video games. And so I was like, if I could just join the Brownies and get the get the best of both worlds, but that was not a possibility.
Yeah.
But was there research on your part yeah. kind of into the Scouts and how that, like, might be perverted and kind of understanding where they were coming from originally?
Yes. Yeah, 100%. I did a lot of research on sort of the history of the Scouts, but also kind of the different iconography of the Scouts. So I was looking up. I remember going through a list of all the different merit badges. I remember in particular looking up the Scout laws. There's a lot of mythology about the founder of the Boy Scouts. You know, down to even this idea of there being there was the Unknown Scout, which was sort of seen as this figure that, you know, helped the founder of the Boy Scouts cross the street. And then he was like, kid, can I give you a reward? And this unknown kid says, no, I'm just doing my good deed for the day. The character of Robert Baden-Powell, the founder of the Scouts, wound up, I wrote sort of an analog figure, Dr. Jefferson Hancock, who, for a character being long dead, like long, long dead, at the beginning of this book, he really casts a long shadow over everybody in this book. He's sort of been reimagined and rethought as sort of this prophet messiah figure. And everybody's asking themselves, hero, villain, anybody in between. Just about everybody's asking, what would Jefferson Hancock do? He's sort of the true North Star for the Ranger Scout ethical compass. And I think that was the thing that really kind of attracted me to this project, was the Boy Scouts as an organization. It's a very rich and detailed organization, and there's so much you can kind of put into it. And, you know, the other thing is that, again, sort of, it can be, there are people who, you know, they still to this day, you know, in their Twitter bios, they say Eagle Scout. You know, you mentioned Boy Scouts and they perk up. That's just sort of been a something that captures their imagination. It's something that has embedded itself into their identity. The same way that talking about comics is something that's been embedded in all of our identities. The thing is that when you have a passion that is that strong, that helps shape you into who you are, you know, it's, they say, you know, too much of a good thing, you know, that can twist you. That can be spun out into a sort of quasi-religious cult kind of thing. But yeah, I feel like I did a lot of reading on the Boy Scouts. The thing that I of course took a few liberties, you know, and I was able to sort of say, well, you know, post-apocalypse, like, maybe their Ranger Scout manual, you know, was a little burned. Or maybe, you know, there were some pages missing. So, for example, I was able to, like, condense the main Scout laws. You know, I mean, the Scouts have way more than the 7 laws that I put up. But I figured, you know, it's like the 10 Commandments, but having a few knocked off. You know, being able to sort of combine a few things. I do remember, for example, I tried desperately. I had several drafts of the Unknown Scout making an appearance, and I couldn't figure out a way to, like, really justify it without it coming across as goofy. And I feel like, in a way, Kit has kind of taken over some of that ideal, mm-hmm. you know, of just a scout doing the right thing for the sake of doing the right thing. and how do you reconcile that in a post-apocalyptic world where like survivalism inherently is about looking out for number one? It's inherently about like, you know, how do I not take the bullet? You know, it's also it's looking up even just, you know, sort of the disappointments, the shortcomings, the actual crimes that the Boy Scouts have covered up in their own tenure. That really, as I was reading it and sort of seeing the echoes of their own abuse scandals, I was kind of like, all right, like this feels right. This feels like exactly the right thing to kind of, the right way to tackle this. Yeah, it just it was a little, I give Aftershock a lot of credit because I think they realized how prescient this was way before I did. And it was only sort of in the initial research stage and really hammering out that outline and taking a few passes at it that I was kind of like, oh yeah, like the transition from A to B is not as far off as we might think.
Oh, no. It's, and we mentioned it kind of earlier and kind of alluding it to it there. I think a bit about, like, you're able to play with it being the post-apocalyptic world, and I think the look and the idea and, like, the almost militaristic aspects that kind of, like, make their way into it. Again, mm-hmm. It's not something the Scouts is, but I do picture, like, even as a kid, I remember, like, you know, they know how to use pocket knife. Like, they knew how to do shit that, mm-hmm. again, I can do in a video game, but I don't know how to do in real life. But, yeah, like, that lends itself to kind of, again, this cooler-looking world. And we talked a bit about it, but I feel like if, you know, if we went this whole interview and wasn't able to harp on
the amazing... I want to talk about Luca,
like, fuck, I mean, dude, the dude drew Dylan Dog, which is fucking awesome, but also, like, was it Lost Soldiers recently, mm-hmm. with Les, was so good.
Just wrapped up, yeah. I've been a huge fan of Luca's since his work on James Bond, funny is I had actually reached out to Luca myself years ago about another project, and he justifiably was busy working on James Bond, and I remember... when we were batting around artists for Scouts Honor, and I remember Mike and Christina would give me a couple of names, and then I would throw a few names back, and then I distinctly remember Mike saying, hold the phone, hold the presses, we just got word that Luca Castellinguida, his schedule's open, and he's looking for his next book, and we pretty much went, like, I think it took all of 10 minutes. I think we're just like, yep, let's do it. Let's go with it. Luca is, for somebody who did not grow up in the U.S., so did not have, you know, that sort of cultural osmosis for all things Boy Scouts, I'm really impressed with the way that he approached this book. You know, he took... I wrote some character descriptions, you know, sort of a mind's eye idea of these characters, but Luca really kind of built it up in a big way and really developed it nicely. You know, his take on Kit in particular, I knew it was going to be kind of a tightrope. You know, I was saying, like, you know, I kind of want to get, like, you know, a more androgynous, almost kind of Kristen Stewart kind of character, because, you know, she's been spending her whole life to quote unquote pass, you know, in this male driven society. The way that he, Luca, for a book that's, you know, post-apocalyptic action, Luca really excels in the quiet moments. You know, he's been able to really kind of give Kit and Dez, to a different extent, and sort of their surrounding characters, this real, you can see the thoughtfulness. You can kind of see the gears turning in their heads as they're sort of thinking about their secrets and trying to sort of keep a lid under all of it. But at the same time, when you do have the action, it's like you can hear the gear switch. And it's like Luca goes from like 0 to 60, and it's just the angles feel sharper, the shadows feel heavier. you realize very quickly that while Kit is probably the most well-adjusted person I've ever written, which is saying something, you know, she's like a trained soldier. Like, she's not the person that you want to get into a fight with. And so seeing, you know, we have some, you know, some action in our first issue, and issues 2 and 3 in particular, you really get to see Kit like kick ass and take names. Luca's versatility is just so incredible. And the thing that I was really impressed by is not only is he so talented, but he's fast. He was knocking out deadlines for this book that, to be honest, I was shocked that he was able to not just like excel at them, but like make them. You know, we talked earlier about like how do you sustainably make a comic, but do so in like a professional pacing and rate of speed. And Luca was knocking out most of his issues within like 6 weeks. It is astounding how good those pages look, given that he worked that fast.
Something with those European mm-hmm. comic approach. I don't know what it like. Maybe cause a lot of their stuff is in a more like condensed weekly. A lot of times for like, they're quick and it's like always the most beautiful fucking stuff. This book is gorgeous.
I say this in every book that I feel like I'm always the weak link, but I really feel like the weak link on Scout's Honor, you know, because I'm the new guy, you know, and so it's like a weird position because I'm in certain ways kind of steering the ship because the idea is starting with me and I got to sort of lay down the groundwork for everybody else. But, you know, working with pros like Luca or Matt Miller or Carlos Manguel, I'm just like, oh, okay, like it was a little bit of a trust fall exercise for me. You know, I've been so hardwired with my other books because I don't have that safety net of like, okay, like the buck stops with me. And I think sometimes that's made me a little rigid editorially. Like I have a set vision, and so I need to make sure that I'm the guardrails that keep the, you know, the car from going over the cliff. And this experience, especially working with Mike and Christina, who they were the guardrails in this case, I was able to kind of like step back a bit and let the professionals be professional and let my team keep adding in their own spins to the mix. I think Luca really, I mean, people have been talking justifiably about how incredible his artwork is, and it only gets better as the series continues and he's gotten more confident with these characters. Even down to I think about this all the time with Carlos, our letterer. I think I've always grown up in the school where, like, you know, you hear it, like, the best lettering's invisible, right? You know, you do some comic craft meanwhile at size 7, I guess, you know, and you're just off to the races. But Carlos actually really kind of added his own spin with the lettering, with his font choice. And it kind of has that sort of gravel to it where you're kind of like, oh yeah, this is the apocalypse. Like, this is kind of a, you know, a scary setting. And so, like, this is not going to be just kind of your normal run-of-the-mill lettering. And I think I've brought him up, but I'll just, you know, in case I haven't, I'll bring him up again. Is that, you know, Matt, I mean, Matt is just incredible. I mean, I've always believed that good color... art makes or breaks a comic, and colors make or break the art. And Matt has really kind of... he's grounded the book with sort of that post-apocalyptic, you know, sense of dust. But at the same time, he adds in these awesome accent colors, which kind of, you know, remind you a bit of his run on Daredevil. You know, he's got these teals, and he's got these magenta reds. And you remember, like, oh yeah, this is like an irradiated wasteland still. Like, this is, you know, it's a little bit of a somewhat alien world. And I think Luca and Matt together, they are a true dream team. And I would be lucky to get to work with either or both of them again in the future.
Yeah, like, it's kind of, again, the team... really working to everyone's strength. I mean, like I mentioned, obviously, Luca doing a lot of American work, but being Italian, had worked on Dylan Dog, and even like the lettering choice by Carlos is like very European. And then again, Matt's ability to kind of like just like it pops more like it again. It like fluidly, this book is really amazing, kind of everything you guys have done. As we kind of wrap up, I'm for you kind of with this series and now it being the first issue out and people kind of reacting to it, like what do you, ultimately, like what is kind of your hope for the series? I don't know if you guys have mentioned, like, what is, do you guys have a series run? Do you have like an idea of where you hope this kind of goes in the end for you?
So this will be a 5-issue series. I had written it with a distinct beginning, middle, and end. I didn't want to, you know, and I've said this, you know, going back to Spencer and Locke, which I'm still working on volume 3 for that, is I never want to overstay my welcome, both in terms of readers and in terms of my publisher. So I had written this as a distinct beginning, middle, and end. Now, that said, I always have another idea in my back pocket. So, you know, if Aftershock, you know, says we want more, you know, I would love to tell the story of the Amazonian Girl Scout cult Splinter Cell that sort of, you know, has trekked to Arizona. That may be a story for another lifetime. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think, obviously, just beyond sort of the lizard brain, I'd like people to like the book. I hope that people read this book, and not only do they get sort of the spiritual side of this, because, you know, that's something that I think is very personal to me, but I hope that as they're reading it and sort of the world around us, which looks a little dystopian, I hope they draw a little bit of hope from it, and they see that, like, we can turn a corner. I'm hoping that the world will cooperate. You know, by the time that this book wraps in May, I think we will have turned a corner in a way. We, you know, it won't be a perfect world. And it won't even necessarily be a status quo world, but we will be sort of moving towards fixing things. And I think that's something that really speaks heavily about this series. You know, beyond that, though, I mean, like I've said, you know, I want to be in comics full time. You know, I want to be here forever. You know, I want to kick the bucket at a con. boy, that was bleak as soon as I said it. You know, I think having a book at this level of platform is really helpful. I want to keep working with Aftershock. I've enjoyed working with Aftershock, and so I want to find the right project to work on with them. But you know, it all goes back to kind of, you know, the old image style pendulum, you know, where sometimes you're working with a publisher and sometimes you're working where you're just way out on a limb and you're doing your own thing and, you know, you're going on Kickstarter and you got no safety net. And I think as you sort of go from one side to the other, you know, that keeps raising your profile and that keeps proving to readers and retailers and journalists and publishers that it's not a fluke anymore. You know, like, I feel like it the best thing about Scout's Honor, and I probably sound like an asshole saying it, I feel like it's kind of killed the last bit of imposter syndrome I have, because I feel like, oh, I can do this in a professional setting with professional editors under a professional timetable, and we can make the book work. And that, I think, is a big step forward in confidence for me. And anybody who knows me should know I'm really bad at that. So, you know, like, my confidence has to be like super well earned, super hard fought. And I think for me, the process of making the book, I think I've gotten everything I could possibly want to out of it. So now I'm just sort of looking, how are people responding to it? And if the first day has been any indication, and knock on wood, it stays that way, I think the reaction is more positive than I had dared hope for, And like I said at the beginning of this interview, I feel grateful. You know, you hear the phrase comics will break your heart, and oftentimes that's true. You can love comics as much as you want, but it's days like this that comics actually love you back. And those are sort of, you don't get a whole lot of victories like that in your life. You only get so many books coming out. You know, I don't care if you're me or if you're Brian Michael Bendis. And I'm going to remember days like this. Those are going to be the fuel that keeps me going when I've got nothing else.
And I think, yeah, on a day where there was a man in bear fur and face paint on the floor of Congress, never more have we not only needed comics, but like the idea that it's, you know, not that far off, and kind of the allegory of what they can provide is important. But also, like, I mean, you know, it's easy to say as someone who, you know, reads comics and stuff like that, but like, again, your stuff has always felt very, very polished and tight, and was very excited for this book. And again, kind of, I mean, even like the idea that this was kind of the first thing at Aftershock, I had assumed, it just like in my mind, I thought, you know, you had done stuff, because like everything I read feels very, again, very tight, professional. But this is a fucking fantastic, like I said, I absolutely love this issue. Everything about, like, it is tight. The art is gorgeous. And I just cut. I was flipping through it while you were talking, and there's the part where she says, "No, ma'am, just doing my good turn for the day," which is fucking great. But yeah, I think anyone, you know, obviously, if you've listened to this, we've had spoilers, but you can go to your shop and pick it. It's because, like, it is something that I think will be. It's in January, so I think come the end of next year when we were talking our list again, I think we'll be up there for a lot of people.
Well, that's what I like to hear, and thank you so much for your time and your support. And anybody who, you know, wants to read Scout's Honor, you know, your local comic shop should be carrying it. If not, ask them to, you know, reorder the first issue for you. Issues 2 and 3 are up on previews now. You can order them with the codes DEC for December, 2011-33 for issue 2, and Jan 211-049 for issue 3. Those will be some fun issues. Issue 3 especially, we get to see what's an Eagle Scout look like in this cult, and what does it take to get to be one. It's about as grueling as you might expect. But yeah, you know, I like I've said, I consider myself so lucky to be here. I've tried every stable job and was not as great with them. But this is, comics are the job that I always wanted, which is the job that I can eat and breathe and sleep all day, every day. It's my calling. And so having guys like you who are, you know, so supportive of my work, that's the reason why I get to do what I do. And for everybody listening, the same goes for you. You know, thank you for believing in me, because that's the first step to me believing in myself. Yeah.
Less thanks to them, more to me and Tim. And I will say, I'm glad you mentioned the preview codes, because, I mean, it's something that often is brought up, but especially currently when, like, I think shops are trying to figure out everything, and with shipping, like, it's so fucking important to, if you have a list or you go to your shop, to pre-order so shops know what to get, again, especially when shops are kind of figuring out what to put on the shelves right now when they might be struggling. It's important to pre-order books. Yeah. Hopefully Tim has used this episode to come up with a second question, because we have already asked you our normal final question, and I completely forgot. Me and Tim were terrible at this. Tim, save me.
All right.
Did we lose? Oh, he's up.
If you had to write one episode of 2 and a Half Men, what would happen?
Well, you know, it'd probably be like a dark, gritty version of 2 and a Half Men. You know, I don't know. I mean, if I did the 2 and a Half Men, I'd probably go for like the multiverse version. They'd probably have a run in with like, it'd be the Chuck Lorre verse, you know, they'd run into the Big Bang Theory guys and they'd run into the mom verse and they'd probably get served by two broke girls. You just opened Pandora's box, man. Like that's my story and I'm sticking to it. This horrible story that you just made me conjure up.
Tim and I think we retire.
I immediately panicked and was like, what's a bad TV show?
Holy shit.
But yeah, that's the horrible fever dream brainchild. You know, somebody asked me the other day, is there anything you wouldn't remix? And I feel like you just found it. like, and not because I believe in the sanctity of Two and a Half Men, but because most people don't know this. You guys, I don't even know if you guys know this, but I used to work at CBS, and so I used to work on publicity on that show. And so never again. I guess they'd have to have, like, a Spider-Verse, like Charlie Sheen coming back from, like, an alternate dimension where he's not dead, and he'd be, like,
see where there was, like, a version of that show where, because I feel like that show had to be, I'm going to screw up, a John Cryer, who seems like a, like, genuinely nice, and, like, put together dude, and on the most, like, fucking insane, I don't want to say awful show, but weird show. And, like, I would just love, like, a, like, almost like a being John Malkovich for, like, John Cryer on Two and a Half Men with Charlie Sheen every day.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, I can't believe I'm going to bring this back as a teachable moment, but I consider The Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men a teachable moment in that it speaks to a way that comics can move forward. Like I said, I worked at CBS for about 5 years. I worked on publicity and I actually wrote the ratings releases every day. So I spoke with our ratings research team. And so, you know, every week in and week out, I'd be writing, oh, Big Bang Theory won the night. And, you know, and I was kind of like, I don't get it. Why? you know, like it's not good, you know, it's not funny. And the research team kind of explained to me, they're like, well, first off, like, yeah, there's like the kind of lowest common denominator humor. And like, you know, a significant section of the country thinks like making fun of nerds is fun. But beyond that, it's accessible. You can watch any episode of The Big Bang Theory or Two and a Half Men or CSI or Blue Bloods. You get the picture. You can watch any episode and the bar for entry is very low. You will get a sense of the Two and a Half Meniness, the je ne sais quoi, of Two and a Half Men in any particular episode. And I think that's something that for a serialized industry like comics, we have lost sight of that a bit. And it's, you know, because we sort of leaned into kind of the more film and television side where we want to have, you know, a big mega arc over a long period of time. And in some cases it works. I mean, you know, you've got the Why the Last Man, the Transmets, the Sandman, you know, of comics. But I think there's something to be said for like basic exposition or like accessibility of concept. And that's something that our industry, I think, still struggles with. But it's something that I've always tried to take to heart in the way that I do things. Down from the high concept to how I introduce every issue. And boy, is it a pain in the ass when you're in issue 3 or 4 or 5, having to explain everything that happened the issue before without, you know, it turning into an exposition slog. But yeah, it's just something I think about a lot. So
Look at like, especially kind of 80s and like early 90s cartoons, like that was the key. Like, they were so afraid of telling any sort of serialized story because the idea was those things would move into syndication and you would not want to isolate a kid. You wouldn't want a kid to tune in and be like, what the fuck's going on? So, like, every episode had to be accessible to any kid because the idea, like, because they would just rerun and you would hit the end of the season. They didn't want someone to be like, oh, like, I've missed a tons of stuff. So, like, the idea was always to be accessible. And then, like, shows like Batman and all those things would kind of not ruin that, but, like, prove the idea that those things could be done differently. But, yeah, like, there's an importance to that, especially when you think of sales and where you want your medium to go.
It's a challenge, and it's something that, like, there's no silver bullet to it, you know? I mean, it's easy to talk like there is, but there isn't. You know, it's just an ongoing challenge that you kind of have to be cognizant of issue to issue. But, yeah, so it sounds like a weird fetish when I say it, but it's like, yeah, every time I sit down to write, I think about the Big Bang Theory. not because it's good, but, like, because that there are weirdly lessons to be learned from it. And so... Yeah, I look at my time at CBS as super formative for my career, in part because I realized very quickly that, you know, you could have, like, the most sophisticated, fancy content in the world, but it doesn't matter half a damn if it's not accessible. And it doesn't really even that doesn't even matter if you don't figure out all the intangibles around it, if you don't promote it. For example, you know, if you don't promote a book, nobody's going to find it. I don't care how good it is. It won't happen. And so these are all things that, like, are constantly the gears grinding in my brain whenever I am sitting down to work on a new script. Comics, everybody.
Speaking of promoting, if anyone wanted to find you me. Or your stuff, how could they do it if they wanted to find out more about Two and a Half Men?
Yes, if they want to hear more about Two and a Half Men. Any listeners can find me on Twitter and Instagram at PeposD. It's my last name, first initial. Yeah. Or David Pepos Comics on Facebook. You can subscribe to my newsletter, Pep Talks. I'm sorry? What was that? I'm sorry? Oh, did I cut out?
No, I think Tim.
Yeah.
I think you cut out.
Sorry. Oh, okay. You can cut it out when you want. People can find, they can subscribe to my newsletter, Pep Talks, at bit.ly/pepnews. Or they can visit my brand new website, davidpepos.com.
Tim, what are you doing?
A lot of sitting in my bedroom alone. But I'm also writing over at Comics Pit, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madura.
And we have shored up our content for once. We are at pages_panels, and I went and figured out how to actually run a podcast a few years in. We are, if you go to anchor.fm/pages and panels, it's kind of like a hub. You can find all the stuff there, but you can go listen on Spotify, all that shit. But I figured out that's an easy way, and you can listen to it on there and do all that shit. I don't know. We're very terrible, but that is something that is now easy, so you can go there and listen. But most importantly is going out and picking out Scout's Honor again. I think people will be disappointed if they miss out on this book. It's fantastic. I just want to look at Luca's art all day.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. It is so hard to get your name out there and get traction. It's a very, very busy marketplace, and it's a very, very busy week in that marketplace. So I just want to thank you guys for taking the time. It certainly means the world.
Now I gotta go read 12 issues of State. I'm not getting any future State books. I'm sure they're good. But yes, very important. And then, Tim, I promise, it's 2021. We will cover an episode of George Lopez. I'm very sorry. We will do that next time.
And I know. If only I was here for the Gutter Boys crossover episode. I know that was the time we were really going to talk about it.
I know. But I know Tim's going to quit the show one of these days because I can't
get to it. You got to get some more George Lopez in there.
Yeah. But thank you so much for listening.